Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please visit the webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on homeschooling right after this. 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight, and a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed this scriptural advice when they put these words at Article 1, Section 10 to our federal constitution. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." That's in our federal constitution at Article 1, Section 10. Now, in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away. In 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, the second, and the fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we are the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my business school conducted twice a year here at the law school. To learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email. Send an email request for the general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about home schooling. It's a wild new concept. I pointed out to you that there were three ways for us to learn, three ways for us to educate our children, I guess I should say. Public school is number one. 47 million American students go to public school. About 3 million now, as of 2005, are attending home school, and about 6 million are attending private schools. Now, by far and away, the public school system has the minds and hearts of the American public. But surprisingly, when polled, 51% of Americans with school-age children said that if money was not an issue, they would educate their children in a private school. Not that they would educate them in a home school, but that they would send them to private school, 51%. Now, that's right at 50-50. So half the people who have children of school age would educate those children in a private school if money were not a consideration. So about half of us, then, aren't really all that thrilled with public school, then, are we? Let's see if we can't get the other half to be less enthralled with it by reading a brief history of homeschooling by Patrick Farenga, I guess it is. Patrick, F-A-R-E-N-G-A, Farenga. Copyrighted 2002, A Brief History of Homeschooling. Listen to the story. Homeschooling is a radical idea to most people. After all, Just how is a child supposed to learn what they need to know to get into college or to get a good job if they aren't learning all of those important things in school? And how are they going to grow into responsible citizens without 180 days or more for 16 years of compulsory public and or private education? And that time doesn't count preschool readiness programs and after-school enrichment programs. Schooling is so complicated and so difficult, and learning is so difficult, that a scientific clinical approach to education seems to be what the best and wisest parent would want for their children. But something is drastically wrong with these modern-day assumptions, which is why alternatives to public and private schooling are now thriving. Homeschooling is radical. And in the root sense of the word, in Latin, radicus means root, compulsory schooling, forced attendance, and now in the 21st century, compulsory education, meaning forced learning, are very recent petals and offshoots of the root way that humankind has historically nurtured its young into responsible adults and active citizens. Family, community, religious institutions, and work were all integrated into the daily lives and upbringing of children in the past. Sometimes there were professional or informal tutors available that some families hired or shared to instruct children at various times for short periods every year. Other families used daily chores, apprenticeships, internships to educate their children. Continuing in these traditions, similar arrangements are made by homeschoolers today. Now, this concept of universal compulsory schooling is a very recent idea, one that is not even 200 years old. And yet we act as if it is ancient, surefire, and it is the only way, the surefire way, to make sure that our children learn something. Now, many teachers, parents, and students have written in many eloquent books and essays about how our children do indeed learn something during their schooling, but often it is in reaction to, or reaction against, or in spite of, or not related at all to the fixed curriculum that they are exposed to in daily doses. America's founders did debate a bit as to whether or not they should force children to attend public school, but they decided to leave such decisions to individual families and local and state governments. The words education and school appear in none of our founding documents. You will not find education or school in our Declaration of Independence. The word education and school does not appear in our Constitution or Bill of Rights. Now, some of our most famous inventors, writers, and politicians were self-taught, learning through mentoring or apprenticeships, conversation, and reading, and this route to adulthood continues to this day. But by 1850, when Massachusetts became the first state to institute a compulsory schooling law, attitudes towards children and their place in society began to change. Children are forced to attend schools for many reasons, but in this early period, it was largely to keep them out of the workforce and to teach them to become good citizens. Nonetheless, one can easily find examples not just of the wealthy people, but of the common people opting out of mass schooling in order to homeschool. Now, parents in the 19th century used itinerant teachers and books such as Samuel Griswold's Fireside Education, published in 1828, and Burton and Warren's book, Helps to Education in the Homes of Our Countries, published in 1863, to help them as they raised their children in their homes and communities. As more laws made public schooling more encompassing of children's time, some teachers and parents questioned the growing consensus that more and more school was better for children, than time spent growing up in their settings, or at least other settings. No one wanted to send children back to work in coal mines, but some people felt that school might not be the best place for children to learn. Now, Tufts University professor A.A. Burrell wrote in the introduction to his book called The School in Your Home, published by Moffett Yard in 1912, that American mass education has been a failure over the past 20 years, and that people from day laborers to university professors have written to him about it. And Burrell claims that he holds hundreds of letters from parents asking him how they can teach their own children at home because of their dissatisfaction with public schooling at the turn of the century. Now, a fascinating example of early urban homeschooling comes from a mother in New York City. Her name, Rita Sherman. And in her book that she wrote anonymously, called A Mother's Letters to a Schoolmaster, anticipates many of our 21st century reasons for homeschooling, such as her deep concern that her son's individual learning style, that her son's individual creativity and his individual intellect would be damaged by standardized, one-size-fits-all education. Her letters show her rationale for homeschooling. Vivid descriptions of the success that she is having with her son as she lives and learns with him, and the schoolmaster's reluctant approval, allowing her to do so. Mrs. Sherman can tend to over-inflame her speech, but she nonetheless makes many interesting social and educational arguments against compulsory education, compulsory schooling, but in support of public education. For example, work, study facilities that are open to all ages. Now, from the 1920s through the 1970s, homeschooling was a relatively underground, usually rural phenomenon. Homeschooling occasionally popped up as a topic of mainstream conversation, such as a two-part series in the Atlantic Monthly in the late 1940s that eventually became a book called The Home Education of a Boy by William Barrett, publisher unknown, but published in 1950. But homeschooling remained at best a fringe topic during this period. Well, all of that changed in 1970 when Ivan Illich, I-L-L-I-C-H, published Deschooling Society, New York, Harper & Row, published in 1970, reissued in London by Boyers, B-O-Y-A-R-S, in 2001. This short book called not for the abolition of schools, but for an abolition of compulsory attendance laws. Illich's ideas and language can be stunning, and deschooling society spurred people into public debate, such as Education Without Schools by Peter Buckman, published by Condor, 1973, and Private Action, No More Public School, Harold Bennett, Random House, 1972. For a man destined for homeschooling fame, John Holt, these ideas spurred him to question his career as a popular education reformer. So in 1976, Holt wrote a book called Instead of Education, Ways to Help People Do Things Better, as his way to show how we can support people to learn without forcing them into conventional schooling. Holt Associates, 1988. And Holt had decided after nearly 20 years as a vocal public and private school reformer that schools were doing exactly what most people wanted, sorting their children into economic winners and losers based upon test scores, and that trying to reform that system was therefore a truly quixotic pursuit. Holt wanted to help make meaningful change in education, and he was tired of being on talk shows and the university circuit as a type of entertainment. So after reading Instead of Education, people from various parts of the country began to write to John, telling him about an option that he failed to mention explicitly in his book, and that was homeschooling. Well, Holt soon turned his attention to those families who wrote to him to say that they were teaching their own children at home. And within a year, Holt founded Growing Without Schooling, GWS magazine, the nation's, if not the world's first, journal about homeschooling. That's called Growing Without Schooling, the GWS magazine. Families of different backgrounds, different religious faiths, and educational philosophies relied on Holt's considerable free advice and help during this time, and he worked to create an inclusive network of support for homeschoolers. Holt recognized that many parents were homeschooling for reasons that he personally did not support, and that he seemed to anticipate the current fractious nature of homeschooling politics when he wrote in the second issue of GWS back in 1977. He said, quote, "What is important is not that all readers of GWS should agree on these questions, but that we should respect our differences while we work for what we agree on. Our right and the right of all people to take their children out of public school and help to plan or direct their learning and education in ways that they think best." Published by Holt Associates, 1999, page 25. In 1981, Holt published a book just about homeschooling. It's called Teach Your Own, A Hopeful Path for Education, published by Dell in 1981. And he was again on the talk show circuit speaking about his ideas of learning in the milieu of family and community, which he called unschooling. Neologism of Holt's. Holt preferred unschooling over the term homeschooling because little of the learning that he was describing occurred exclusively at home, and most of it did not resemble conventional schoolwork. The work of educators, Dr. Raymond Moore and his wife Dorothy, also became more well known to the general public during the 1980s. The Moores had already written extensively about the value of delaying formal education until at least age 10, based upon their work and research within the federal government at various universities, and they readily embraced homeschooling as a complement of their work. The Moores soon became vocal and popular advocates for many homeschoolers, particularly Christian families. And by the early 1980s, more overtly conservative and religious homeschooling publications and groups emerged, some in direct reaction to Holt's ideas about education, and others as a way to avoid sending their children to what they perceived as the godless monstrosity of the public school system. Homeschooling easily accommodated the differing factions, reasons, and political views of these various groups, the beliefs that these groups espoused, and it is now becoming more of a mainstream choice than a radical move. Indeed, homeschooling has grown tremendously from Holt's estimate of 15 to 20,000 children being taught at home in 1981. To a recent federal government survey that found nearly 850,000 children are being formally homeschooled, or formally, I should say, homeschooled in the United States as of 1999. Homeschooling, in many ways, is a return to the roots of our society, where family, community, religious institutions, and work are all integrated into the daily lives and upbringing and education of children. Homeschooling, including mentorships and apprenticeships, still serves to educate many of our children's, or our country's children, as it did a majority of our influential leaders throughout our history. Bolstered by the works of John Holt, as well as Dr. Raymond Moore and his wife Dorothy, arguments supporting homeschooling began to be widely communicated through books, magazines, and popular media during the 1970s and the 1980s. Holt's theories about schools being a place for sorting children into economic winners and losers based upon test scores rings very true for many, influencing an ever-widening range of families who embrace this style of learning for their children in place of public school. With a federal government survey finding nearly 850,000 children being homeschooled in the United States as of 1999, this style of learning is definitely a trend, not a fad. So how then is a child supposed to learn what they need to know to get into college or to get a good job if they aren't learning all of those important things in public school? Well, throughout history, homeschool children have been showing us how. And reflection on the history of homeschooling identifies this trend. And it is an interesting and increasingly popular and enriching lifestyle that has been evolving with our culture's dynamic approach to helping children learn. Now, I might mention here that Sandra Day O'Connor, a justice of our Supreme Court, Ben Franklin, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington were all homeschooled. I'll give you some names of some other people that were personally or homeschooled or personally trained. But let me give you this brief history of homeschooling. It was written by Patrick Faringa, F-A-R-E-N-G-A. Let's see if he's got a website. He does. You could probably tune in too. This is the author's biography. Patrick Faringa worked closely with John Holt and is the president of Holt Associates Incorporated since 1981. He has published numerous books, articles, and tapes about homeschooling and about John Holt's unschooling ideas in particular. Pat and his wife homeschooled their three girls, ages 16, 13, and 10. He has addressed audiences throughout the United States, Canada, England, and Italy about homeschooling. And he has appeared on the Today Show, The Voice of America, NPR's The Murrow Report, and CNN's Parenting Today. Faringa works as a writer, speaker, and education consultant. To contact him or to learn more about John Holt, visit this website, www.holtgws.com. That's www.holtgws.com. His latest book is Teach Your Own, The John Holt Guide to Homeschooling. All right, that website again, www.holtgws, all one word, .com. Now, let me give you some information here concerning some of the most famous people in American jurisprudence. You're about to read the names of 12 of our nation's most prominent lawyers. One of these men was a law school dropout. Let's see if you can guess his name. I'm going to give you 12 people here. Patrick Henry, John Jay, John Marshall, William Wirt, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster, Salmon P. Chase, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Clarence Darrow, Robert Story, Strom Thurmond. Those are the 12 most prominent names in American law, American lawyers, American jurisprudence. Four of those people, John Jay, John Marshall, Roger Taney, and Salmon P. Chase, were chief justices of the Supreme Court. Now, one of those men was a law school dropout. Let's see if you can guess his name. Patrick Henry. He passed his oral bar examinations in 1760, and within 3 years, Patrick Henry had handled more than 1,100 legal cases. He was a member of the Continental Congress and later became governor of Virginia. John Jay was admitted to the bar in 1768. Subsequently, John Jay distinguished himself as the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. John Marshall passed his bar exam in 1780 and later became a Supreme Court Chief Justice. William Wirt was barely 20 when he practiced law in Culpeper County, Virginia, and he eventually became United States Attorney General. Roger Taney was admitted to practice in 1799. Roger Taney served as first Secretary of the Treasury, then as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Daniel Webster was admitted to the Boston Bar in 1805, and he established a phenomenal legal reputation, and he also served as Secretary of State in 1841. Salmon P. Chase gained his early prominence as a defense attorney for runaway slaves and also later became Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Abraham Lincoln gained his experience as a lawyer, and he became the 16th President of the United States. Stephen Douglas was admitted to the bar in 1834. Douglas later became a representative and then senator from Illinois. Stephen Douglas is best remembered for his debates with Abraham Lincoln. You maybe have heard the name or the term the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Clarence Darrow was a lawyer of world renown whose most famous case was the Scopes Monkey Trial case of 1925. Robert Story was born in 1893. He served as president of the American Bar Association in 1952 and 1953. Strom Thurmond was admitted to the bar in 1930, and he later became governor of South Carolina, then senator from that state. Now remember that one of these distinguished gentlemen is a law school dropout. He abandoned law school after the first year, never to return. Can you remember the names? Was it Patrick Henry, John Jay, John Marshall, William Wirt, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster, Salmon P. Chase, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Clarence Darrow, Robert Story, or Strom Thurmond? Well, if you guessed the name Clarence Darrow, you guessed correctly. Clarence Darrow was the law school dropout. That's right. Clarence Darrow, the one name that the whole world associates with the practice of law, attended law school for only 1 year. He did not distinguish himself in the year that he did attend law school, and he dropped out to study law on his own. Now, in concluding, we should tell you that the other 11 distinguished American lawyers could not have dropped out of law school because they never attended law school at all. That's right. 4 chief justices of the Supreme Court, 1 president of the United States, 1 secretary of state, 1 attorney general, 1 president of the Bar Association, and 1 Strom Thurmond, a governor of South Carolina and a senator from South Carolina for about 40 or 50 years, as long as I could remember, never attended law school. Not a day. Now, public school has an inefficiency problem. And Diana Mertz, her last name is spelled H-S-I-E-H. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that, so we're going to call her High. Diana Mertz High, leaving the S silent, I would imagine, H-S-I-E-H, wrote a treatise on the inefficiency of public schooling. It's an undergraduate paper for American Economic History, Washington University in St. Louis, 27 November 1996. The inefficiency of public schooling. Let me cover that with you when we come back right after this reminder. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week and here, both here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The law school and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, our schedule, and our archive. And it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use in this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements and or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate by endorsing the Law Hour or Editorial Review. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed necessarily by the Law Hour and Editorial Review, or vice versa. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about homeschool. Is there an advantage or a benefit to homeschooling? The Inefficiency of Public Schooling was published by Diana Mertz High, H-S-I-E-H. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Diana. Despite all of the differences between human cultures, the stock of knowledge that a society develops plays an enormous role in its growth. The increases in material well-being and prosperity, which arose during the Industrial Revolution, were substantial, from the development of the steam engine, a portable source of power, to Eli Whitney's use of interchangeable parts in manufacturing. Today, the development of new drugs have saved countless human lives and alleviated an enormous amount of suffering, and computers have freed people from countless hours of drudgery. The growth in life expectancy in the last century testifies to the power of new knowledge, even though that figure cannot directly account for the improvements in the quality of life. In order to be useful, new knowledge must not simply have been discovered. It must be applied, and applied to particular problems, and disseminated to the portion of the population that can best use it. The knowledge that babies' bones will grow straight without swaddling, for example, would have had very little effect if most parents had remained unaware of this fact. Additionally, the growth in the stock of knowledge must be preserved over time by passing down that knowledge to the younger generations. The beginning and most basic level of that process is the acquisition of a certain level of knowledge by the young, which will allow them to competently navigate the world. Children who do not learn to read, write, and do basic mathematic and arithmetic skills will be limited in profession to the most menial jobs and will be, for the most part, unable to enjoy the prosperity and the material well-being of their educated counterparts. Additionally, a whole society benefits from a workforce educated in these basic skills because it will be flexible and easily trained. For example, more efficient and more productive than a workforce lacking these skills. For many years now, the public education system of our nation has been the primary means by which basic knowledge, that is, the knowledge of reading, writing, and mathematics, has been disseminated to the vast majority of Americans. Despite its recent disgraceful record in actually teaching children the basics of knowledge required for life, support for the idea of a system of public education is still very strong in America. Compulsory public education is widely regarded as the only alternative to little or no education at all for a large portion of our population and as the system that has saved a nation from ignorance and backwardness. Public school gets all the credit. But to state it more formally, public education is regarded as an efficient response to the problem of widely disseminating to children the basic knowledge necessary for a prosperous society. Any claim to the efficiency of a system of public education ought to be suspect at best. Public schools have increasingly failed to educate students to even these basics, such as reading and writing, let alone the more advanced skills like algebra, despite huge increases in expenditures per student over the past few decades. The ratio of public to private school students also indicates little, if anything, about the efficiency of public schools, since revenues for public education are derived from taxes, not simply from parents of students in public school. Now, the record of public schools in actually educating children and its effect on our economy is quite apparent. American students, even our top students, lag very far behind those of other industrialized nations in both math and science. David Harmer writes that, according to Adult Literacy in America, which is a 1993 report from the National Center for Education Statistics, nearly half of adult Americans are barely literate. 50% of Americans are barely literate, with such limited reading and writing skills that they cannot perform simple tasks like writing a letter to explain a billing error. Now, the effect of this abysmal education on the economy is clear. Firms have a much less attractive labor supply, and they are forced to educate those workers that they hire themselves in their own corporate schools or attempt to import more educated labor from other countries around the world. In the newspaper USA Today, it was reported that U.S. corporations spend $25 billion a year teaching their employees skills that should have been learned in public school. The Motorola Corporation spends $50 million a year teaching 7th grade math and English to 12,500 factory workers. That's nearly half of its hourly employees. And Kodak Corporation is teaching 2,500 employees how to read and write. That was published in USA Today, February 3rd, 1989, Section 1B. The decline in the education of American students has occurred despite the threefold increase in spending per capita from 1959 to 1989. In the 1959-60 school year, the average cost per student, adjusted for inflation in 1990 dollars, was $1,621 per student. By the 1989-90 school year, expenditures per student had reached $4,960. Additionally, the United States spends more per student on elementary and secondary education than all but one nation in the world. And the data comparing test score ranking of the SAT and the NAEP and state spending per pupil, published by the Wall Street Journal in June of 1993, show, if anything, that there is in fact an inverse correlation between scores and spending. For example, North Dakota ranked first and second on the NAEP and the SAT respectively, but North Dakota ranks 46th in spending per capita per student. New York, on the other hand, earned a 22nd and a 35th ranking in the NAEP and the SAT test scores, even though it outspent 48 states, spending $7,500 per student. In sum, no matter whether the comparison is done across time, whether the comparison is done with other nations, or if the comparison is done between states, our public education system is grossly inefficient, it spends enormous sums of money on education, and yet it only marginally educates its students, which is evidenced by the fact that 50% of Americans today are just marginally literate. Now, unlike in much of the economy, the much higher percentage of students in public rather than private schools cannot be regarded as a reflection of the true preferences of parents and students. And that's because parents must pay for public school for their children through taxes, regardless of whether or not their children actually attend public school. The financial burden of sending a child to private school is much higher than the cost of the private school tuition itself. Now, a poll by the National Association of Independent Schools showed that 51% of parents nationwide would send their children to independent schools if cost were not a factor. Although it is unclear what exact percentage of students would attend private rather than public school, if the true cost of each were paid for by individual families, the ratio of public-private attendance would certainly shift towards private school attendance. The evidence of the dysfunction and the inefficiency of our present public school system is crystal clear. But less clear is whether public schooling has always been this inefficient, considering the alternatives of, for example, government voucher programs or completely privatized education. This is a very difficult hypothesis to test, given the limited amount of historical economic data and the vast differences between our society today and that of the 18th century. What we can, however, examine is the assumption that universal public education was required based on the lack of education of the population at the time that public schooling was first instituted. To that end, I will examine the literacy rates and the other indicators of how widely the basic stock of knowledge was disseminated. But even more importantly, I will look at the arguments of the historical promoters of this public school system. Promoters such as Horace Mann, to see whether these public schools were actually created in response to a need to greater and more widespread education, or whether there was some other need or some other agenda that was being advanced. Now, the literacy rates during the colonial period and the early history of the United States indicate that literacy was steadily growing during that period of time to rather high levels. For instance, between 1650 and 1795, for example, male literacy rates were estimated to have risen from 60 to 90% over that period of time. By 1840, literacy in America was estimated to be between 91 and 97%, and there is no evidence that there was an undersupply of schools or any lack of interest in education in the United States. The 1828 Journal of Education, for example, reports that our population of 12 million people, for the education of which we have 50 colleges, besides several times the number of well-endowed academies, leaving primary schools out of the account. For meeting the intellectual needs of this 12 million population, we have 600 newspapers and periodical journals. Now compare that with Poland during this same period of time, 1828, who at that time had a population of 20 million people, yet only 15 newspapers. The United States even fared better than England. By 1850, the United States led the world with 18% of its population enrolled in schools of some sort. In New England, the proportion was even higher. However, Liebergott estimated that even by 1860, the average child in the northern states of the United States was only spending, on average, 3 months in the classroom each year. And this last figure is not as important as it may seem at first, because children learn their most important skills, such as talking, and in most cases, reading. They learn those skills outside of the classroom. And it is a non sequitur to assume that the child inside the classroom is learning more than the child outside the classroom. Nevertheless, the data from these time periods is not as precise as one might like it to be. For that reason, the motivations of the creators of the public school system might well be more fruitful. Now, in his book, Separating School and State, Sheldon Richman examines the ideological roots of the public education system with which we are saddled today. Contrary to popular conception, public education was not created because parents were not educating their children, but rather, public education was created because parents were not educating their children the way the state wanted those children to be educated. Compulsory public education was essentially designed to allow the state to take over the parenting and the education of children, so that children could be molded into obedient, docile servants of the interests of the state. Although this view sounds terribly severe, it does fit perfectly with the ideology of the historical advocates of compulsory state education. In 1819, Prussia created the first system of modern compulsory schooling, which was designed to unify the nation and serve its needs for better soldiers after their defeat by Napoleon's army. That is reported by Gatto on page 9. And the educational system was thoroughly fascist. Franz de Hove, that's H-O-V-R-E, I guess that's Hove, wrote in 1917 that a fundamental feature of German education is education to the state, education for the state, and education by the state. The Volksschule is a direct result of a national principle aimed at national unity. The state is the supreme view in end. And to that end, the Volksschule, which educated 92% of German children, was not designed for the purpose of intellectual development, but rather socialization in obedience and subordination to the state. Gatto, page 14. Now, according to John Taylor Gatto, nearly every one of the founders of American schooling had either gotten a German PhD or studied under someone who had, for example, Horace Mann and John Dewey. And many wrote reports circulating the German method of education. Gatto, page 21. For example, Archibald Murphy, the founder of the North Carolina Public Schools, wrote, quote, "In these schools, the precepts of morality and religion should be inculcated and the habits of subordination and obedience formed. Their parents know not how to instruct them. The state, in the warmth of her affection and solicitude for their welfare, must take charge of those children and place them in school where their minds can be enlightened and their hearts trained to virtue." Unquote. Education, according to John Dewey, ought not to be designed for the intellectual development of the individual, but rather a means of social reconstruction, which adjusted individual activity to the social consciousness. Now, nearly all of the founders of American public schooling regard the state's need for obedient citizens as of much greater importance than individual liberty, independent thought, or even learning itself. A healthy economy, on the other hand, requires self-reliance, intellectual curiosity, and a willingness to learn, not the passive, bored, aimless, and even worse, destructive and violent children that public schools have created. Much more could be said about the destructiveness of the methods by which children are taught, or the ideals such as egalitarianism with respect to ability that public schools promote to the detriment of most children, particularly the brightest children who attend those public schools. But it already seems clear that public schools were created with very little regard for the individual life of the child or the economy's need of an educated workforce. It is then no wonder that compulsory public education has failed miserably on both of these counts. All right, this is an essay that was written by Diana Mertz High, and I'm going to pronounce her name high. It's H-S-I-E-H. It's an unusual name. Let's see if we can get you in touch with her webpage. Boy, this is a... Let's try www.dianahsie.com. E-H. Just got her name in here. Diana H-S-I-E-H. That's .com. Now, it also has a /undergrad/TIOPS.html. So let me give that one to you again. It's www.dianahsieh.com/undergrad/TIOPS www.html. Published 6/26/05, or at least that's when I got the document on my desk. All right. Now we're talking about public versus private school, or more particularly, homeschool. Did you notice that in these two treatises, they fit perfectly with the same observations that were made by Zach Montgomery back in 1886, that the more money you spend on public school, the poorer the performance will be of the students that come out of it. It was true in 1886, and I told you that, and I said, now I'm going to document it. And so I came back, and I said, let's take a look at the year 2005, and we find that North Dakota spends less per student than New York State. And North Dakota, in results, scores number one, and New York scores about number 35th out of the states. Or it was 22nd out of the states. About halfway down. So the more we spend on public education, the poorer the performance of the students. When we take a look at literacy, we find that the literacy rate in America has dropped from almost 100. That is, 90 to 97% were literate. And I showed you that literacy back in 1850 was at the level of college today. I showed you in the last program a test that came out of the 8th grade of Kansas in 1895. I gave you an example. I gave you some samples of those questions on that test. Literacy in 1850 would have been equivalent to a college degree today. Literacy. Let me give you another illustration. Today, the average vocabulary of students in high school is 10,000 words. 10,000 words. The average vocabulary of the average person on the street today is about 3,500 words. If you go to college and study language, you may have a vocabulary as high as 20,000 words. But a 20,000 word vocabulary was the norm in 1850. Let me repeat that. Today, the average is 3,500 words. That's all you use in your everyday vocabulary, just talking Joe to Sally. 3,500 words. If you've graduated from high school, your vocabulary may be as high as 10,000 words. If you've been to college and studied language, it may be 20,000 words. But in 1850, the average vocabulary was 20,000 words. Now talk about the deliberate dumbing down of America. And the dumbing down has been accomplished through the public school system. Now in our last program, tomorrow, we'll take a look at homeschool versus public school solutions. How do you solve this public school dumbing down? And what kind of results should you expect? All right, we're out of time. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Keep in mind that you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Says my time is up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.